So even though Shavuos is over, Rus still remains true, regardless.
And cheesecake is still
there. Cheesecake is still, leftovers still in the fridge for many of us, it's true, you know. Cheesecakes go fast in my house, but other leftovers still in the fridge. But, you know, the book of Rus is relevant all year long, so even though Shavuos is over, we could still study Rus and still draw out more of the lessons. And I think last time we had gotten up to the end of the second parak, the second chapter, so we're up to page 1271, and the beginning of chapter 3. And chapter 3 is a very fascinating chapter. Let's just kind of put it in perspective for a second. The first chapter just set up who Rus is, who Naomi is, and gave us her story in terms of her origin. That was chapter 1. Chapter 2, spoken about Rus encountering Boaz in his field, meeting Boaz for the very first time. And chapter 2 was, in a certain way, it was pretty mundane activities. You know, they were hungry, they needed food, she went to collect leket, she went to collect the gifts for the poor. She met Boaz, she got some extra food, she brought it back home. That was chapter 2. So we learned a lot from chapter 2, but in terms of the events of chapter 2, it's not all that exciting. It's, you know, pretty mundane, everyday events. Chapter 3 is very unique, because chapter 3 is where Naomi now steps in to become a real player in the story. Until now, everything Rus did came from within herself. In chapter 1, she decided to convert and to go with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law told her not to, and she refused and went along with her mother-in-law. In chapter 2, Rus is the one who decides to take the initiative and go and collect leket and bring back food to her mother-in-law. That was chapter 2. In chapter 3, Naomi perks up. And Naomi now comes up with a brand new plan for Rus. And she becomes really the guide and director of the story in chapter 3. Now what's about to happen in chapter 3 is that this is where Naomi is going to try to orchestrate the marriage of Rus and Boaz. We know that Boaz is a relative, a first cousin of Naomi, a nephew of Naomi's late husband Elimelech. We know that Boaz is somebody who has the ability and the standing to redeem Naomi in her fields and marry Rus. We know that, we'll talk more about that. And Naomi wants to figure out, how can I get this to happen? We need this match to happen. Naomi has an insight, seemingly deeper insight, even with Ruach HaKodesh, with some sort of divine inspiration. This match needs to actually occur. We have to be sure that somehow Boaz and Rus unite. And Naomi wants that to happen.
Is this during the Yovel period?
A Yovel period.
I mean, you said redeem the lambs.
Yeah. Well, the story we'll see later on is that she is about to sell the field, and she wants to sell it to a relative rather than to a stranger. That's the way it's described. It is during the time where Yovel applied.
Right.
So that means that sold fields would eventually come back. But the fields, we'll see, were not yet sold, but they're on the verge of being sold. And it's a matter of she wants to be able to keep it in the family rather than sell it off to somebody else. But we'll see that much later on. So in the third parak, the story is going to change. Naomi's taking the lead, and she sees there's divine hashkacha, divine providence here. And she understands that everything which transpired in chapter 2 was for a reason. The fact that that Rus happened upon Boaz's field was not just a coincidence. She met Boaz and collected in his field for a good reason, because this was God setting up the picture in order so they can unite. She personally, it seems, until this point, never dreamed that Rus would marry Boaz. Now, Boaz was the respected elder, Gadol Hador, the sage, the leader, the wealthy man. Rus was a convert from Moab, disliked by many. And she never had in her wildest dreams that these two could actually unite and become a married couple. However, once she saw the events of chapter 2, and she saw God's hand in the story, at that point she said, okay, this could actually happen. And she wanted to bring her dream out into fruition. So that's kind of the setup for chapter 2. So let's begin with chapter 3, I mean. Let's begin with the first verse in chapter 3, and we'll try to understand some of the story. So Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, I must seek security for you, that it may go well with you." So it's interesting how she presents it to Rus. She's about to present a plan. She doesn't say this is for my security, for my well-being. She says, it's my daughter, my dear Rus, my beloved Rus, my daughter. I have to make sure that you are secure. I want all to go well with you. And we see that Naomi's intentions in this whole story were really for the well-being of Rus. She had no personal motivation here. For herself, she wasn't so interested in setting this all up. But she wanted to see it through, that her daughter-in-law, Rus, would have this security, this happiness, which she's looking for. And this shidduch, this match is so unlikely, so surprising. Naomi understands it only is going to work if we take drastic measures. And the next few verses are going to show us the drastic measures that need to be taken in order for Ruth to be able to marry Boaz. And for those of us who know the story, we understand it's a very drastic measure. And those who haven't learned the story before, we'll see how drastic these measures really are. So Ruth the Moabite said to Ami, let me go out to the... I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong chapter. Chapter 3. Now Boaz, our relative, with whose maidens you have been, we winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. So again, this is the harvest season. So they just harvested all of their barley, and now they're going to winnow the barley. That's they're going to sort out, you know, the waste from the good pieces of barley. So he's going to be tonight on the threshing floor. So Rashi explains that why was Boaz at nighttime on the threshing floor? I mean, typically the work's done during the day. In those days, nighttime was extremely dark, no electric lighting. They didn't do work at night. Why was he there? So Rashi tells us that he actually was sleeping with all the grains. And the reason being that the generation, as we said before, is very corrupt. There are a lot of thieves out there. And Boaz wanted to protect his property. He didn't want people coming to steal from all the grain he just harvested. So he personally slept there to guard his grain. Now we should all have a question. Because
how did Nomi know?
What?
How did Nomi know that he's sleeping there at night?
Oh, how did she know? I mean, it could be that there was a known fact. It could be she watched him and knew. That could be she knew. But
couldn't he get somebody to do it for him?
Yeah, that's the question, right? But Boaz was a wealthy man. He had employees, he had workers, he had guards. Why didn't he pay somebody just to sleep there at night? He didn't trust anybody, maybe. What?
He didn't trust them.
Okay, it could be people were so corrupt he didn't trust even his workers. That's very possible. That's very possible. But the question is glaring, that why would this wealthy, you know, aged, you know, guttle, why would he sleep guarding his own grain, not pay some employee that he had to watch the grain? So why would he do that?
He's 80 years old.
Yeah, right. He's an old man. He's not a young man. He's not a young man at all. So what is it that he did? Why is it he slept there himself? So the rabbis teach us a very important lesson. The rabbis tell us, Sadikim mamonam chavileam migufam. For a tzaddik, their wealth is more precious than in their own body, which we'll explain in a second. And the Gemara says, why? Because they don't steal. They don't take stolen goods. So there's a concept that for someone who's a tzaddik, you're a very righteous person, your money is very dear to you. And we think at first glance, so that's kind of strange. Yeah. He's materialistic, he cares about his money.
Yeah.
But it says the reason why it's so dear to them is because they don't steal. They're 100% honest with their money. So what's the lesson here? So obviously there's an importance we see of being careful with our own money. If Boaz is willing, I'm going to take it into my own hands to protect my property, it must be, it's very significant to be sure that we are careful with our money. But there's a very important lesson which you find, I think, in this whole idea, in this story, which is that when we view money in life, money is a tool that God has given us to use to do what needs to be done in our own personal missions in life. All of us have whatever property we have, whatever money we have. And if we work honestly, we act honestly, we do what we're supposed to do. So whatever money comes our way, we say, this is the money that God has provided for us. For some people it's more, for some people it's less. But everyone has the money God has given to them. Now why does God give them this money? God says, I'm giving you certain tools to fulfill your mission in life. Everyone has an individual mission. Everyone has a mission to do. And for different missions, you need different tools. You know, if you're a carpenter, you'll need to have a saw and a hammer and a screwdriver. But you probably won't need a scalpel. So you have to figure out what tool you need. And if you're a surgeon, you need a scalpel, but you don't need a screwdriver. You know, if you're an accountant, so you probably don't need a hammer, and vice versa. You have to know what's your job. And if this is your job, you need to have the tools for your job, and that's how you'll fulfill your mission. So God says, okay, this person deserves this salary, this house, this car. Now, if the person steals and cheats, is dishonest, so you can't say, oh, God gave me that. You say, no, you stole it. That's not what God gave you. That's not what you need. That's not for your mission. That's somebody else's mission that you're trying to take away. But if you're being honest and you're acting honestly, working honestly, not cheating, you're doing what you're supposed to do, and you end up with a certain amount of possessions and assets and property, so we understand that God has given this to me because this is the tools for my mission. This is what I need. So you can imagine, let's say there's a... the carpenter, and he's taking all the measurements, and he gets to the job, he's missing one 2x4, one piece of wood. So he can't do his job, because he took that precise measurements. My job is I have to build, you know, this chest, and it has to be this wide and this deep, and I'm missing some wood, so I can't do the job. So a tzaddik who's so honest, every penny they have is exactly what God gave them for their job in life. So they say, well, if I'm missing one barley kernel, I'm going to fall short in my job. Now, we can't always figure out what's that barley kernel for. I don't know exactly why I have every single penny that I have. But Boaz knows deep down, every single barley kernel which I possess must be here for a reason. And I must need that barley kernel. Whether it be to give a little more tzedakah, to buy a little more meat for Yontif, to add a room onto my house, whatever that might be, but I need that barley kernel. I need that.
Is that why Yaakov goes back for the Parfum Katan?
Exactly. I'm going to get to that also. Very good. Perfect example. So you find this example with Yaakov. Yaakov, he crossed his family over the river, and then the Torah says he went back to the other side of the river and wrestled with the angel. So the rabbis, the Gemara, they say, why did he go back? What was he doing to go back? And they say, very strange comment, he went back to get some small jugs he left behind. Where the rabbis see that in the verse is not clear, but the lesson is clear. Yaakov Avinu as well, for him, even though it was just these little small jugs, he felt they were very significant. And that's exactly the example given when this point is said in the Gemara, that for a tzaddik, their money is more precious than their body. Because he understands, if I don't have those jugs, I'm not sure what they're for. Without those jugs, I can't fulfill my mission in life. I'm missing something. Yaakov was known to be 100% honest at his work. He's the example, the Rambam cites him as the example of honesty on the job. He is the example. So he was 100% honest. He doesn't take anything stolen, he doesn't cheat, he doesn't lie, he doesn't cut any corners. So he knows every single jug that God gave me, I have for a particular reason. Does he know at the time why? I don't know if he knows at the time why he has every single jug, but every jug is there for a reason. And if I go across the river and I don't go back to get these jugs, I'm going to get to a point where I have to do something in life and I'm going to be missing out on my mission because I'm missing out on some of the property God gave me. I'm missing out on my tools. So this is a very important lesson from Boaz. So Boaz said, even though I could pay someone to do the trick, but I need to be there. This is my property. You know, there's a wave of theft in the whole area. And I need to be sure that everything I have is protected because for me, I'm honest, I don't steal. Everything I do is exactly as God desires. And therefore, every single grain of barley needs to be under my watch. It's also a more basic and broader lesson. You know, being wasteful is certainly discouraged under Torah philosophy and Torah law. Because if I'm being wasteful, again, I'm wasting the tools God gave me. And I'm wasting the money God gave me. So God gave us money, and we are supposed to be the stewards of this money. We're supposed to use it appropriately. So we have to figure out how to use it. But if we're acting in a wasteful manner, then we've thrown away some of the tools God gave us to our mission in life. So that's a lesson we have here from Boaz. So back to our story, though. So Boaz is sleeping at the threshing floor that night. And let's go to the next verse 3. So Naomi then starts to give Rus this plan, which seems to be, again, a very strange, you know, in some ways outrageous plan. Therefore, bathe and anoint yourself, don your finery, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. So she tells him to sneak in at night, and we're going to see in verse 4 as well. And when he lies down to go to sleep, note the place where he lies, and go over, uncover his feet, and lie down. So Boaz is going to be sleeping in his bed at night, and Ruth is going to sneak in and lie down at his feet. So very, very strange plan. And then it says, he will tell you what you are to do. And at that point, you know, let Boaz decide what's going to happen. So she tells her to prepare for the plans. The first thing she tells her is to bathe, change her clothing, put on her perfume. So on a simple level, it means you should go down there looking nice and smelling nice and being clean, I guess to attract or to impress Boaz. That'd be the simple understanding. Rashi explains, again, this is based on the Midrash and the Gemara. Rashi explains that washing here means a spiritual washing. You should wash away any sense of idolatry that you have. The anointing, the perfume, means you should anoint yourself in mitzvos, in good deeds. You should have that merit. And when it says change your clothing, the Gemara says it means put on your Shabbos clothing. So there's a much deeper concept which is shown over here, which is that this is not just a woman trying to attract a man. We're talking here about two very, very special, very, very holy, very, very elevated people. We're talking about this will be the relationship that brings about the Mashiach and David HaMelech, King David. So this act where Ruth is going to try to convince Boaz to marry her has to be done on a very lofty, high level. She has to be prepared spiritually for it. So it's not just put on your nicest clothes and smell good, but it's that you have to go down there in a state of holiness and purity. No thoughts of idolatry, no impure thoughts, in Shabbos clothing, which means they're endowed with the holiness of Shabbos, and with the merit of mitzvos. Because you're going to need a lot of merit for this. Because this could backfire. Very, very, very easily could backfire. Instead of it becoming the impetus to marry you, he might at this point say, you know, the chutzpah, how dare you come and do this to me? Get out of here and I never want to see you again. You know, that risk is right there as well. So it has to be done with the most holy of intentions, the most pure of intentions, with the preparations and the spiritual level so you have that merit. And so Boaz can actually see that she's here in a very sincere way. If Boaz thinks she's trying to attract him, you know, just like some woman is trying to attract some other man, he's going to be offended by it. What do you mean? I'm somebody, my whole life, I've kept standards of modesty and of holiness, and you're just going to come into my bedroom like that? Like, how dare you? But if Boaz can sense on her that she's there with a mission for God, and she's there in a very holy way, she's there with the preparations on a high spiritual level, at that point, maybe he will recognize there's a certain divine providence in this entire meeting. And that was the goal. So she wasn't preparing for some sort of like immoral, you know, intimate rendezvous, but it's a holy mission. And the preparations, which Rashi's highlighting, show us the sanctity of this mission. She also needs a lot of help from God, because again, this is a major moment in Jewish history that has potential to backfire against her, and without having the merit of the mitzvos, and also the merit of Naomi's blessing, who says it's going to succeed? So that's what's happening in verse 3. Now, verse 4 tells us the actual plan, which is, okay, go down and lay down at his feet, and then he'll wake up, he'll see you there, and he'll tell you what to do. And that's verse 4. So again, it's drastic measures, but it shows you the significance of the situation. In the field, Boaz knew she was, Boaz recognized her, but we don't find much beyond that first meeting. We don't see any interaction. They had that first meeting, and Boaz told her how great you are, the chesed you did for your mother-in-law was tremendous, and please sit at my table and eat my food. But then she went on harvesting in his field for weeks and weeks afterwards, and we don't find any more connection being made. And Naomi recognizes this, and she says that, you know, I'm hoping that he'd make a move to marry you, to redeem us, but I don't see that move being made. So if it's going to happen, there has to be some drastic plan put into place to make it happen. And that's exactly what they're trying to do right now.
Down at his feet, and now he was not so sneers.
Correct. But
she's coming in holiness.
Yes.
She's laying down at his feet.
Yeah.
It's like two opposite things.
So I'll talk more about that in a minute. I'm going to read first. This is if you look at, you know, this is another version of the Art Scroll Book of Rus. It actually has a very interesting preface to this chapter. I just wanted to read a few quotes from there. So it says that, let's find where I want to. The future prospect of Ruth's meeting Boaz was remote. And Naomi feared that since Boaz had not taken initiative and Ruth was so at hand, he could hardly be expected to respond to more conventional suggestions of marriage. For all they knew, Boaz might even be offended at the mere suggestion of his marrying Ruth. After all, Naomi was destitute, Ruth was of foreign Moabite stock, and Boaz was a man of substance, the judge and leader of the generation. Could she expect to approach him and simply ask him to redeem and marry this girl? So Naomi was convinced that the condition of the stalemate could not continue. Things had to be brought to a head one way or the other. So it must be remembered halachically that yichud, being secluded with a single girl, wasn't yet prohibited at this time. That's a rabbinic law which was brought into by King David's court later on. That's number one. So there's no prohibition in them being secluded together. So Naomi decided the best course of action, even though it was daring and unconventional, was for Ruth to approach Boaz herself under the most personal circumstances and remind him of his responsibility to the family of his dead uncle Elimelech. In a personal confrontation, convinced that her motives were sincere, his compassion for her bitter plight might be evoked. So that's how it introduces it. So we're setting up the scene a little bit. Again, it's still the plan itself does seem very strange, and we'll talk about there's a deeper reference which she's making with the idea of being by his feet in a minute. But Naomi sees, you know, this is it. We got to make a move. You know, this will be make it or break it over here. But either it's going to happen or it's not. But we have to really just put him on the spot and confront him and see what happens. And that was the goal.
Credit to Ruth that she listened to such an idea.
Yes, you know, we'll talk more about that as well. She was hesitant. Yeah, she was very hesitant about this idea. So we find that, it's interesting, we find that tzaddikim, and this commentary is pointing out, great tzaddikim had a tremendous urge to give birth to great lines of the Jewish people. For instance, we know that Yaakov knew there'd be 12 tribes. And Yaakov was just waiting for the moment he can give birth to the 12 tribes. We know when he couldn't marry Rachel at first, he married Leah. He said, give me my wife Rachel, I want children with her, and let's get moving with this. So it wasn't because he was interested in Rachel's being attracted to Rachel. It's because he wanted to be able to create the Jewish people. We find the story between Rachel and Leah when Rachel couldn't have any children, and she wanted to have the dudaim, you know, this herb to help her be more fertile and give birth. So there's this very funny interaction between the two. You know, you're taking away my husband, and you're taking away my herbs, and it's strange, like how they're fighting in that way, and they're kind of playing games and like bargaining about time with their husband. But the answer is, these people were very, very righteous, and they understood that we now are creating Klal Yisrael. We're bringing about the Jewish people. We're doing something which is going to change the world. There's a famous story of Tamar and Yehuda, which, when you read the Chumash describes it, seems to be quite, you know, immoral and illicit. But yet the sages tell us that they had the best of intentions in mind, and God says, this is all my plan. This is how I want it to occur, because this is how we're going to bring Mashiach into the world. And again, with Rus as well, Rus is here to bring Mashiach into the world as well. And even though this whole interaction seems to be quite, you know, strange or illicit, or any other word you want to describe it with, it was all part of the great urge of these great people to understand that they're doing tremendous things for the history and the future of Klal Yisrael. And there's a much deeper reference which is made over here. And this the Malbim points out. Why does she tell her lay at his feet? She could sit on a chair in the room. She could do a lot of things. Like, well, why is laying at his feet the proper place to lay? And furthermore, it says you should uncover his feet. Why is she uncovering his feet? I mean, he's going to get cold. Waking him up, maybe? Like, leave his feet covered. So the Malbim says a very, very important idea. The Malbim says this entire story is pointing at the concept of Yibum. Now, the classic case of Yibum is if a man dies with no children, so his wife is supposed to marry his brother. And if they do marry and have kids, those kids are considered carrying on the name of her late husband. That's the idea. Because if he dies without children, there's no one to carry on his name. So therefore, if she marries his brother and they have children, these kids will carry on the name of the dead husband. That's the concept of Yibum. Halachical Yibum only applies between, you know, two brothers. That's where it applies. However, the concept of Yibum on a much broader level could apply to a more distant family as well. You find that a few times in the Torah, such as the instance of Tamar and Yehuda. You find instances where the concept of Yibum could be extended beyond two brothers carrying on each other's name. So the idea of Boaz marrying Rus, we regard as an application of this concept of Yibum. Elimelech died and his children died. There was nobody left in that family. Rus was the connection to Elimelech's family, which still remained. So when Boaz marries Rus, he's not just marrying a destitute girl. He's actually carrying on the name of his late uncle and late cousins. That's what he's doing. And he's allowing this family to actually still have some continuation in this world. That's the concept of Yibum. Now we know when one does Yibum, there's a choice that can be made by the woman. She can either marry him, or they actually are both involved in the decision. But the choice is they marry or they do chalitza. That's the choice. And chalitza is a ceremony which is done to say, I'm not going to marry you. They're going to separate. And then they move on with their lives and they can both go ahead and, you know, marry who they like. The ceremony of Yibum, of chalitza, is a very strange ceremony. I've never seen one before, but maybe some people here have. But chalitza, the ceremony is done that she removes the shul of the living brother and spits. it's a very interesting ceremony. And why are you removing the shoe? Like, why is there a shoe involved in the ceremony? It's a very funny thing. Like, we understand the concept of, you know, a divorce requires a get. It's a document. Okay, there's a legal document passed on. They say a person's divorced. But to remove a shoe and to spit, like, you know, where does this come from?
Doesn't it have to do with embarrassment? You're supposed to cause the guy embarrassment?
So that might be a slight part of it. But the shoe has, I think, a bigger meaning. And the Malbim explains, this is more of a deeper concept. The Malbim explains that the body to the soul is similar to the relationship of a shoe to a foot. Meaning what? You know, if we don't have shoes on, then we can't really do much in this world. You know, we'll hurt our feet, we'll get scraped, we'll get cut. I once heard somebody speak a survivor that they wanted to escape from one of the camps, and they had a plan, and the other inmates didn't want to escape because there was always repercussions from the guards. So they stole their shoes. So next day they said, we're not going to try to escape without shoes, we'll never make it. So they didn't go anywhere. They didn't, at that point they didn't escape. I don't know what happened later on. This person survived somehow, so I don't know if they escaped or what. But the shoe is what allows us to interact with the world. That's what it allows us to do. And if we don't have a shoe on, we're kind of stuck in place because we can't really do much without our shoes on. So the same thing with the body and the soul. The soul is like the foot and the body is the shoe. You know, the soul wants to interact in this world, but it can't without a body. We need a body to interact with this world. The soul without a body is just, you know, some sort of hovering spirit. It can't do anything in our world. So the soul needs the body in order to interact with the world, the same way that the foot needs the shoe to interact with the world. That's what the Malbim explains. So the concept of Yibum is essentially telling us there's a soul out there, a soul which has no continuation in this world, no remaining family. And this soul so much wants to have some connection to the world, and it can't because it has no family left in this world. So what do you do? So if the remaining family performs Yibum, that's essentially giving a shoe to the soul, because they're allowing the soul to continue having some sort of connection to this world. If they decide against Yibum, they want to do Chalitza, what they've done is they removed that shoe. They said, you can no longer be interacting with this world, you're cut off, finished. So the ceremony is, okay, you don't want to do Yibum, so we're going to remove your shoe. Symbolically saying that the spirit of your late relative is now going to be no longer connecting with this world in any form anymore. That's the idea. And that's why the Torah says that when they do chalitza, the man's referred to as Beis Chalutz Hanal, the house of the removed shoe. That's his title from here on out, is the house of the removed shoe. He's the guy without the shoe. Because he's blamed that you should have helped your dead brother continue having a connection in this world, and you've cut him off. That's considered a negative thing. Happens to be nowadays we discourage Yibum and we always do chalitza for other reasons. But initially, the way the Torah describes it and the way that halacha was, Yibum was encouraged and chalitza was discouraged. Again, nowadays Yibum is not done, only chalitza is done, but that's for other reasons which will come up later in history. So when Rus goes and lays down at the feet of Boaz and uncovers his feet, what's she telling him? She's telling him, you have in front of you an opportunity of Yibum. You have relatives that passed away and have no remnant in this world. If you go ahead and you marry me, then we can continue on their name. That's what you can do. If not, then your feet are going to be uncovered. It's like chalitza. You know, you're going to be cutting them off, taking away their shoes in the symbolic sense, and there's no more connection to them in this world. So that was the reference being made by Ruz by laying at his feet. That's the way the Malbim describes it. So it's much more than just lay there and wait for him to wake up. You know, she chose the feet for a reason, because the whole ceremony of Yibum really surrounds the concept of feet and shoes. That's what it does, both physically and spiritually. So that was the reference being made. So Rus is really urging Boaz, make a decision. Recognize the opportunity in front of you, and either choose to marry me, or you're going to be losing your shoe. That's the message being given. So let's move on now to verse 5. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything as her mother-in-law instructed her. That's 6. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. She replied, all that you say to me, I will do. Thank you. All you say to me, I will do. So there's actually something very curious here in the Hebrew. If you look at the Hebrew side, "Vatomer leha kol asher tomri elai ese." Now the word "elai," if you look at the notes, it says "kuf lo chaf," which means it's a kri and not a ksiv. It's not written. If you look at the actual text of the Megillah, it's not there. But the person who's reading the Megillah will say it orally, and it's a very rare thing. You have this, I think, maybe a few places in Tanakh, nowhere in the Chumash, to my knowledge. That you'll have something that the person who's reading it publicly will actually say a word that's not written at all in the text. Now, more common is where you have a word written and you say something different. A kriyin siv, very often you'll find that there's a word written in the text and you're supposed to replace it when you read it publicly. That we're more familiar with. But here, there's a kri, there's something to read, and there's nothing written. And it's very curious. Like, why would it be that this Megillah is written with a word missing they're supposed to recite orally? Either should be there or shouldn't be there. Which one is it? So I saw a commentary explain the following point, which is very interesting. You know, Rus is very hesitant about this. you know, Russ is risking her reputation as well. You know, at this, to this point, you know, people always were suspicious of me because I'm a Moabite convert. But I've proven myself. People recognize that I'm a righteous woman, that I'm modest, that I keep very, very high levels of sneis and of sanctity. And I've developed, you know, a certain respect amongst the people of Beis Lechem. And she has. Even Boaz recognized her as a holy, modest woman. Boaz recognized that. If I go and I pull off this plan and it turns against me, I'm going to ruin my reputation. People are going to say that, you know, I'm an immoral, immodest person. I, you know, sneaking into men's beds in the middle of the night, like, what are they going to think about me? But yet, Naomi urged her to do it. And Ruth said, even though I'm hesitant, deep down I don't agree with you, and I'm nervous about it, but I'm going to listen to you anyways, because I trust you. And because she's really risking herself, she's putting it all on the line for this. So in the word a lie means that, kol asher tomer, a lie, so the word a lie means that I feel it myself, to me. Anything you say to me, I'll do. But deep down, I agree with you. The word a lie is not here in the text. Because deep down, she didn't agree with Naomi. Deep down, she felt very, very nervous about this plan. So ultimately, she was listening to Naomi. So in the way that we recite it, she says, okay, whatever you tell me, I'll do. But the Megillah is giving us a deep insight into Rus, that even though she said, whatever you tell me, I'll do, deep down, the word a lie isn't really there. Meaning that deep down, she didn't really agree with this plan, and she felt very, very nervous about executing the plan. You know, for good reason. But she said, I'll do it because Naomi, I trust you. I know that you have the best intentions in mind, and therefore I'm going to go ahead with it. So then in verse 6 it says, Vatered Hagoren, she went down to the threshing floor and did everything as her mother-in-law instructed her. So she followed her mother-in-law's words. So Gemara points out that the order here is actually reversed. Because if you look back in verse 3, it says, bathe, anoint yourself, don your finery, and then go down. In verse 6 it says she went down to the threshing floor first, and then she did what she was told. So Naomi was telling her, get dressed at home, and then go to the threshing floor. She said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to go there in my regular clothes, and I'll get dressed over there. And the reason being, very simply, that if people saw her walking around on a regular day, you know, wearing her perfume and her finery, walking into the threshing floor, that's going to draw a lot of suspicion. So why Naomi went the other way, I'm not sure. But Ruth said, okay, I'll do what you say, but I'm going to do it over there. I'm not going to do it at home. I'll do it there so no one sees me, and then I'll just sneak right into his room. I'm not going to walk around in my Shabbos finery in the middle of the farm on a Tuesday night. I'm not going to do that. That's what she says. But she did as she was told. And you do sense here a very, very powerful comparison, I think, to Yaakov as well, when he went to steal the brachos from his father Yitzchak. We know that Yaakov was somebody known to be an Ish Emes, a man of truth. He didn't want to fool his father. And his mother told him, okay, you know what you have to do? You have to go and dress up like Esav and pretend to be Esav and steal the blessings from your father Yitzchak. And she says, Alai ki loscha bani, which we understand to mean that even though you're nervous about it, I'll take the responsibility. If your father curses you, it's the curses upon me. And the Targum Unkelos tells us that I know this is right based on a prophecy that I received. That's Targum Unkelos tells us. But here as well, you know, just like Yaakov was nervous, and his mother told him, don't worry, it's all in my hands, I'll take responsibility. So too, Ruth says, I'm very nervous about this. And Naomi says, don't worry, I know it's the right thing to do. Listen to me and it'll turn out okay. So that's what happens. Let's see verse 7. So now finally she's there at the threshing floor. She gets dressed. She's putting on her perfume. She's clean. It says, Boaz ate and drank, and his heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of the grain pile, and she came stealthily, uncovered his feet, and laid down. So she actually executes the plan. She goes and lays down at his feet. So the Rashi tells us, when it says that Boaz's heart was merry, what it means is that he learned Torah before he went to bed. He was studying Torah, and he was merry with Torah. That's what Rashi tells us. And what does it mean on a broader level? It means that when Boaz was happy, he was a very, very holy man. He was a very high level. His happiness didn't come from food. His happiness came from his spiritual accomplishments. So to say that Boaz had yitav libo, had a happy heart because he had a good dinner, that wouldn't fit Boaz based on the way we understand who Boaz was. So really Boaz was happy and he was merry, not because of his dinner, but because of the Torah he had studied. And it really shows as well that what's going to transpire in this story is that it's going to be coming from a source of true holiness and sanctity. I mean, before Ruth came in, it says that she did mitzvos, she put on her Shabbos clothes, she cleansed herself of any idolatrous thoughts. Before Boaz went to sleep, he studied Torah. The Midrash says that he ate and he benched in a happy manner. And he's going to bed based on a platform of Kedusha and holiness, and so is Ruth. So when they interact, it's not going to be just a man and woman in a bedroom, it's going to be an interaction of holiness. That's what it's going to be. And then that's kind of setting up the scene for this holy couple. The Midrash also contrasts another person we find who also had his heart Mary, which is in the previous Megillah that we spoke about, Megillah's Esther. I guess that was before Pesach. Megillah's Esther, Achashverosh, it says, K'tovah v'melch b'yayin, that the king's heart was merry with wine. So it says that Boaz drank and he had a merry heart, and it says that Achashverosh drank and had a merry heart. But you see such opposites. Because when Boaz drank, his heart was merry. He was put to the test. You have a beautiful young woman in your bed. Can you have willpower, self-control, and remain in your holy level? And when Achashverosh became drunk, he came and instigated immoral actions. He called in his wife to come in the nude, and he wanted to instigate, based on his drunken stupor, all this immoral acts. Whereas when Boaz had this merry heart, it was with Kedusha, it was the sanctity, it was the purity. And therefore, Boaz, with his merry heart, he was able to act with pure morality, as in a very big contrast to Achashverosh, who acted with pure immorality. Let's see the next verse, verse 8. So what happens now? So she's laying at the foot of his bed, and it says, in the middle of the night, the man was startled and turned about. There's a woman lying at his feet. So Boaz is, you know, understandably so, is quite surprised. He went to bed in a nice, quiet room in his farm, and he wakes up, and there's this lady lying at his feet, and he's very, very startled. So the this term, it says Vayechrad Ish Vaylafis. You know, he was feared, and he was startled. That's Boaz. So we're describing his shock. I mean, the shock's on many levels. Number one, if you're woken up in the night by a stranger, either way, it's shocking and scary. that's number one. Number two, he sees it's a woman. He's somebody respected as the Gadol Hador. He's the sage of the entire generation. He lived a life of morality and sanctity. He preached morality. If he's caught up in this, in a compromised situation, he's going to ruin his whole reputation. You know, 80 years of his life's work down the drain because they see this person is not always cracked up to be. He preaches holiness, he preaches sanctity, he preaches morality, and look at him. He has this single girl in his room in the middle of the night. So Boaz, in his mind, you know, he could be thinking, you know, how dare she? The chutzpah, you know, risking my entire life's work for this? So that's one reaction Boaz can have. But on a deeper level, I once heard the explanation that there's a deeper reaction here. Boaz, before it says in the pasuk that he was terrified, and he turned, and he was, you know, he was shaking. The way it's translated here is that he was startled. Vayecharada ish. You know, he was terrified. He was trembling before he recognized it was a woman. The pasuk says he was startled, and he trembled, and then he turned and saw there's a woman lying at his feet. But he trembled even before he saw the woman there. So again, the simple understanding is because there's some stranger waking me up in the middle of the night. That's the simple reason. But on a deeper level, somebody is on such a high spiritual plane, like Boaz. So the same way that we have a natural reaction to danger, Boaz has it to spiritual danger. I mean, for all of us, you know, we can, even though we haven't processed it in our brains to think what's happening, if danger comes our way, we react. Something flies at our face, you know, we flinch, we close our eyes, we move away, we don't think about it, it's just a natural reaction, it's an instinct. You know, if something's very hot, we draw our hands back. You know, we have reactions that are built in by instinct to protect us when we're put in a dangerous situation. If you reach a certain spiritual level, you have the same reactions to spiritual danger as well. So Boaz, he didn't have time to process, there's a woman here, you know, maybe I'll be caught up in an immoral act, he didn't even think about that. But he immediately was just, he trembled by it. Because it was like that reaction we have to physical danger, Boaz had to spiritual danger. And that's a level that people can reach. Somebody is so in tune with God and spirituality, so for them, spiritual danger becomes reality to them. And their neshama, the same way the body responds to physical danger, the neshama can respond to spiritual danger. So Boaz didn't even need to think and process in his mind what was happening before he responded. He responded based on the fact that there was a spiritual danger there, and his body instinctually recoiled at spiritual danger. It's a level which, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, but it's a level which, you know, great tzaddikim can reach, because when you're so in tune with the neshama senses things around that we don't sense with our bodies. So this is a true example of a very, very holy man, a very uplifted, elevated man. Just one other point, and then we'll conclude with this for the week. So this whole instance happened, it says, b'chatzi alayla, in the middle of the night. Now that term should be familiar to us, because on Pesach at the Seder, at the very end, we have an entire piyut, an entire poem that lists all these things which occurred to us in the middle of the night. And the truth is, many, many seminal events in Jewish history happened in Chatzi Laila. You know, the most famous one being Makas Bechoros, the last plague to free us from Egypt. But that piyut lists many, many other events that are in Chatzi Laila. And this is actually referenced there. But beyond that, it could be that the fact that Chatzi Laila tells us the importance of the event, and even in Boaz's mind, if Boaz was aware of the time of the night when this happened, it could be this helped Boaz understand the importance of this moment. I mean, Boaz's reaction we're going to see was not what we expect. We expect him to scream at her and throw her out. That's what we expect. But yet, Boaz is going to embrace the opportunity and see this to be a moment where he's going to bring about Mashiach. He understands the importance of the moment. So I would think part of what contributes to this, certainly it's the piety of Rus, the preparations that she made, Boaz's, you know, keen instincts, understanding people and sincerity of Rus and understanding Hashem's Hashkacha. But I personally think as well that the fact is the middle of the night is very significant, because Boaz knows that important events for Klal Yisrael will happen in Chatzi Laila. We've seen it over and over again. And the fact that she is here, and it's Chatzi Laila, and all these strange events led up to this, I understand this to be a very important moment. Now, why is it that midnight is such an important time for us? That's, you know, it's certainly in secular culture, midnight is considered, I think, a negative time. You know, a time where things are kind of scary, and where things are kind of, you know, haunting. How come in Jewish thought, Chatzi Laila is a time for miracles? What?
Tikkun Chatzos.
So many people are up saying Tikkun Chatzos, but the Tikkun Chatzos itself is mourning. It's a tragedy. So I don't know the answer to the question, but my feeling is that, you know, we as Jews very much move in sync with both the seasons, the sun, the moon, the light, the darkness. Chatzi Laila is the moment where the night turns towards the day. That's the moment Chatzi Laila. Until that point, it's just getting darker and darker and darker and darker. And midnight is when it starts getting lighter and lighter and lighter. So being that's the reality, that's scientifically of Chatzi Laila, of midnight, so too these events for Klal Yisrael, which are bringing us to the light, they happen also at midnight. That's what I would suggest. And in particular, Mashiach, you know, this is the act of bringing about Mashiach. That's going to be the great, 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 etc., grandson of Rus and Boaz. And Mashiach's job is to take us from the darkness into the light. That's his job. Now, we live in a world of darkness and concealment, and Mashiach's supposed to come and bring us into seeing God's light and God's goodness. So it makes a lot of sense. The Chatzi Laila, where the whole night starts heading towards the light, is the moment where Mashiach is conceived, at least conceptually, that he's going to bring us from the darkness to the light as well. So that's my thought in terms of why the Chatzi Laila is such an important time in Jewish thought. But you can open up your Haggadah at the end, you can see a whole list of things that happened in Chatzi Laila, and they are all very, very important events in Jewish history. Right, exactly. Okay, so I think we'll stop here for the week. So next week we'll try to continue more into Boaz's reaction to Rus and move from there. So again, next week is the last week before the summer, and after that we'll continue, God willing, in August.